Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In the fascinating world of medical discovery, the interpretation of how and when a person died is a story that sometimes can be explained by looking at the bugs that are found on the body of the deceased person. Dr. Michael Bodden, the chief medical examiner for the New York State Police, is the author of Dead Reckoning, The New Science of Catching Killers. He's our guest in this archive edition of Radio Curious, the second in a two-part series on forensic pathology, originally aired in January of 2002, on the study and public discussion of how, when, and where someone died. I spoke with Dr. Bodden from his home in New York City and asked him to tell us the importance of what bugs found on a dead person's body suggest and sometimes prove about the cause of death.
Bugs, and mostly we speak about maggots, but any kind of beetles and flies can be very helpful to the forensic pathologist in lots of different ways, to the forensic scientists in lots of different ways. It used to be, 20 years ago, that maggots could tell us how long somebody was dead, because in a place like New York City, during the spring, summer, and fall, when we have a certain kind of flies around, apparently a lot of pregnant flies. As soon as somebody dies in near where flies are, the flies get an odor. They come rushing over, and they lay their eggs in a moist area on the newly dead body. They'll do that in animals, too. They go to animal bodies, human bodies, because the flies are trying to find a place for the young to grow. And we could then look at the development of those eggs and tell how long that body had been dead after being exposed to the flies. And it works in the northeastern part of the United States that the type of flesh flies here the eggs will hatch in about 24 hours and become little crawling maggots, and those maggots will grow and go through various stages until they form a pupa case, sort of like a caterpillar does, and then a fly will hatch out of it about 21 days after the eggs are laid, about 21-day cycle. So we could look at those maggots and get a good idea how long the person was dead, up to 21 days. There would also be various beetles and other flies that would come to the scene, and there would be waves of these insects over a period of time at different stages, and each of those beetles would tell us a life story cycle also.
So different kinds of bugs come at different times in the period of time after the person dies.
Yes, that's right. And by looking at the how far they've matured, we can tell, or we do this usually with an entomologist, we can tell how long the person's been dead, which is often an important factor in a murder investigation in particular. Out in California, you have different kinds of flies, and some flies out in California can mature in 7 days, in a week. So you have to know the species of fly that we're dealing with. But if the scientist doesn't know it, the local Museum of Natural History always has some kind of entomologist who can be very helpful. So that's where it stood about 20 years ago, where we could use these insects and these eggs and larvae to tell us how long somebody was dead. Then about 8 years ago, it turned out that we could find various poisons and chemicals in the bacteria, in the maggots that were feeding on bodies, especially when there was no more tissue left to do toxicology, and one could find barbiturates and evidence of heroin use and other drugs in the maggots when they were no longer present in the body. because of decomposition.
So in other words, you could look...
Even though we didn't have tissue to test it, we could test the maggots.
Okay.
And then, just in the past few years, it turns out one can now find, with all this new technology and DNA technology, sufficiently large strands of DNA of the person fed upon, so we could tell who the decedent was, the DNA of who the decedent was. And that's been a big breakthrough, because one can identify who was dead, what the maggots were eating on. We had a case like that where the body had been taken and disposed of so that it was never found a few days after the death, and we were able to find maggots at the scene that had the DNA of the body that was disposed of, because they had had a chance to develop and start eating up on the flesh of the decedent.
What happened in that case?
That's a recent case. It's ongoing. It's going to trial. And it's a situation in which the scientific proof of death is in the DNA in the maggots, because otherwise the person has disappeared and the body has not been found. But you mentioned another point there, which also tells us something, is that sometimes when bodies are moved after death, we can determine that, you know, whether it was a primary crime scene or a secondary crime scene, because you find a body in the woods. Did the person die there? Was the person dumped there? And we've had situations where the bugs on the body didn't match the bugs in the local environment where the body was found. So one could arrive at a conclusion that the body death occurred in another place that had a different kind of insects, and some cases have been able to trace back the body dumped at one spot having come from a spot 50 miles away where those other bugs lived.
In your book, you have a large section about a bug school in Rensselaer, Indiana.
This is a very specialized field.
But it's a rather revealing field.
Yes, there's a great deal that can be done with bugs to help investigate a death. At the same time, most entomologists work for universities or work for museums, the bug doctors. And there are only a very few bug doctors around who are involved in forensic entomology, which is areas where bugs can help solve crimes. And the only really full-time forensic entomologist in this country, a very interesting fellow named Neil Haskell, who's in Rensselaer, Indiana, and has a bug school. He has bug schools there, and he has bug farms where he looks at bugs as they eat up usually pigs, and to see the waves of maggots and beetles that come into a body, and how we can tell when the death occurred, whether the body was moved after death, who the decedent was. And this is a regular school, mostly for forensic scientists and police officers. He comes up once a year to New York State Police and does a school with our people. And just fascinating.
It sounds like an area where a lot of people would probably be repulsed, yet it provides an enormous amount of scientific evidence to identifying a victim and perhaps a perpetrator of a crime.
Yeah, I think you're raising an important issue, Barry, about people being disgusted and repulsed. Actually, upset at the dead is not so much at the dead body, but the act of dying. See, I'm most emotionally involved to a person in the process of dying, say from cancer or heart disease. That's a very emotionally draining situation. But as a forensic pathologist, once we get the dead body, there's no pain and suffering on that person. And if the body is mutilated by animals or humans after death, those are clues. Those are areas we have to investigate, and that didn't cause any pain or suffering to the dead person. So our job is largely to use what may be upsetting to some people in ways to help the public, to help catch the right guy, to help train people, to help educate, and to learn what we can from the dead, which isn't as upsetting and painful to me as treating somebody who's in the process of dying.
Helping to catch the right perpetrator is as important as vindicating someone who is falsely accused. Can you tell us about how your work has been used to vindicate people who have been falsely accused?
Well, I think I would go further than you, Barry. I think having the wrong person imprisoned is much more damaging than not catching somebody, in part because 40% of murders today in the United States, there'll be 40 murders today in the United States, 40% will go unsolved. Half of them will go with nobody getting arrested and going to jail, doing any jail time. So our ability to solve murders in this country has diminished a lot since I started out in this field. When there used to be a 92% solve rate, and when I started out, now it's like a 60% solve rate. And so a lot of people get away with murder in this country. A bigger tragedy is getting somebody convicted who's innocent. And part of that is not only is the innocent person, if any of us can imagine being in jail for life or going to death potentially for a crime we didn't commit, but the real guy is still out there. The real perpetrator is still out there potentially doing a lot of harm. So that there's a double problem I see with convicting the wrong person. And in our business, we have to be careful as forensic scientists not to automatically rubber stamp the initial police opinions of what happened. And I think that happens too often in this country, where there'll be an initial police interpretation of who the bad guy is, and the forensic scientists and the forensic pathologists will then try to make their findings fit that scenario. And it's not just overzealous prosecutors, which many of these are, but it's because the forensic scientist, who should be impartial, bends to try and make the case better for the prosecutor and the police as a rule.
I want to take a moment and say that this week we're talking with Dr. Michael Bodden, the author of a recent book entitled Dead Reckoning, The New Science of Catching Killers. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Michael, you can use modern technology to go back and examine old cases or cases that have been lying without resolution for years and years, or some that have even been resolved and that are ready for a reevaluation. How do you do that, and what are some of the cases that you've worked on?
Well, what's interesting is now one can apply current technologies that weren't available in days gone by. And this is often done with historical cases. Like one of the discussions we have in the book is the investigation of the Romanov death, Tsar Nicholas, Alexandra, Alexei, Anastasia, who were killed in 1918 by Lenin during the Russian Revolution. We were able to go back some 75 years later to look at just found remains and identify who the decedents were by applying modern DNA technology to what would have previously been unidentifiable remains, and determine the individuals and the cause of death. We went back to Zachary Taylor in 1850. He dies president of the United States. And remember, his tomb was entered, and hair was taken that was still present from 1850 to evaluate whether or not he was killed by arsenic poisoning, an issue that had been raised and proved. We were able that the forensic toxicologists and scientists in Kentucky were able to prove that he was not poisoned. In more recent times, when there are active murder cases, I think the best example is Medgar Evers, who was killed in 1963, a few months before President John F. Kennedy, by somebody who shot him in the back. And there were two trials in 1963 and 1964 in Jackson, Mississippi, with the defendant being the fellow who owned the weapon, whose fingerprints were on the weapon, found 100 yards away, Byron Della Beckwith, the head of the local white supremacist group in that area, and there were hung juries. And in close to 30 years later, when the governor's papers were released, after 25 years, they opened up the governor's papers in Mississippi, because it was shown to be had been jury tampering by the governor, by the governor's office, a new trial was looked into as a possibility, and we were able to exhume the body and get all kinds of evidence, ballistic evidence in particular, that led to the conviction of Byron Della Beckwith 30 years after the event, even though there had been that long passage of time.
What were some of the specifics that you found?
Well, this was all written up, and a movie was made, Ghosts of Mississippi, where Whoopi Goldberg played Mrs. Medgar Evers beautifully. When the new information came up that there was jury tampering, the district attorney, Ed Peters, who was down in Jackson, Mississippi, wonderful fellow, looked back at the case and determined that the autopsy had been lost, the bullet had been lost in the interim in 28 years. So we called and we exhumed the body to see if we could reestablish the bullet trajectory. And it turned out when we exhumed the body, he was in excellent, excellent condition. We were able to not only reestablish what the bullet trajectory was, the corpus delicti, that he was shot in the back and it came out the front, but also we were able to get bullet fragments, even though the bullet wasn't recovered, to show the jury that it came from that same kind of bullet. And the jury was very impressed afterwards, they told us, by the fact that we had the fragments, that we had an x-ray to show the fragments that established to them that this was the same bullet that had been lost in the 28 years in between. And he was convicted 30 years after the murder based on new evidences that weren't available in 1963. And this goes for a lot of cold cases now that we're looking at, largely from DNA, but also from ballistics and toxicology. They're just now.
Can Barry, you tell us about some of the investigations that you're working on now?
Well, right now we're in the process of investigating the Boston Strangler up in Boston. There was a series of about 11 or 12 murders in Boston in the early 60s that were never solved. And although Albert DeSalvo was called the Boston Strangler because he confessed to the murders, there was no evidence to hook him up to the murders, and he was never charged with the murders, and he was killed in prison. And the case was closed then for 35 years, and the family of Albert DeSalvo and the family of the last murder victim, Mary Sullivan, got together and they started a lawsuit because they want to find out who the real murderer was. And there are other people who were being considered before DeSalvo confessed, allegedly, to make a book deal and to make money in those days. And we know there are a lot of false confessions.
Where are you now on that investigation? Can you tell us?
Well, we've exhumed a couple of the bodies. Albert DeSalvo, we've exhumed the last Mary Sullivan. We've gotten DNA from both of them. We've gotten DNA from the vaginal area of Mary Sullivan, who was the last of the victims. And that DNA doesn't match Albert DeSalvo. And there's a lot of evidence at the collected at the crime scene on this last victim, semen from the vagina, from the mouth, from the bedspreads, and the lawyers are trying to work out some kind of arrangements with the Boston authorities to compare the DNA and to see if it matches the DNA at the crime scene and if it matches any of the other suspects who are still alive today that the police had but didn't pursue.
In addition to criminal activity within the United States, you've also traveled to Russia to look at Tsar Nicholas II and his family and descendants.
Yeah, what had happened in around 1990, some bodies were found in Siberia in the Ural Mountains in Yekaterinburg, the same city that had the anthrax scare some 10 years, 1979. They had found a family of bodies, about nine bodies, skeletons, in a unmarked gravesite in the mountains. And the issue came up whether that was the Romanov family or not. And I was asked with a team of four other forensic scientists in the United States to go over there to see if we could identify whether these were the Romanovs or not. And we were able to go over there, and by first doing anthropological measurements, height, weight, sex, race, and dental measurements, and finally by DNA measurements of the bone, were able to establish conclusively that they were the Romanov family, that they had been shot, they had been buried in this unmarked grave, and that Anastasia was also dead. It was not alive. Alexei was not alive and well, as Walt Disney would like.
Michael, one of the things that you mention in your book is something called junk science, science that's not real.
Yeah, and that's an increasing problem, because we have junk science, one that people give credentials and say things that aren't true, and then we have out-and-out fraud, where people just come along and say things that are known not to be true, but they'll say they'll do it anyway. And this works out. We've had some real scandals with forensic scientists in Chicago, in Oklahoma City, in West Virginia, in San Antonio, Texas.
Well, what are some of the things that they did wrong?
The forensic scientists would find things to support the police subversion of the case, like a DNA match in cases which turned out to be false, that it was only, or there's a forensic pathologist who would say he did autopsies that confirmed the police version of how the bullets went, how the stab wounds went, and when the bodies were exhumed, an autopsy hadn't been done. He just made up a whole autopsy in order to support the police version of things. In Chicago recently, the head of one of the labs there, when she found that there was that the semen did not match the suspect, instead of saying they didn't match, just said it was inconclusive. And this poor guy went to jail for 13 years until somebody was able to get the specimen and test them and show that he was excluded as the rapist in this murder case. When the scientist was afraid to say that because there's this team approach mentality that we're all on this team together, the scientists, the pathologists, the district attorney, the police, to get
well,
the bad guy.
That's a difference between the team approach and support somebody that you think did it, as opposed to out-and-out junk science, isn't it?
Well, I think an awful lot what happens is that the scientists, be it pathologist or be it the criminalist in the laboratory, can get an attitude that what they're supposed to support the police version of things, and they'll exclude evidence that's helpful to the defendant, and it's not only junk science, but it's also, as you said, bad and fraud science, where they make up results. And that often the defense attorneys don't seek to have an expert review those results. And if an expert for the other side would review it, they'd find the mistake. But very often they don't have money, they don't have time, they don't have the ability sometimes. The judges won't allow the defense attorneys to get the underlying basis for the conclusions of the DNA or the toxicology. And the people, innocent people, get convicted.
Well, Dr. Michael Bodden, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious, and I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, what's interesting is I've finished two books recently that are kind of a contrast. The Harry Potter books, which I loved, as to see what people are reading in general, and an old one, the first murder mystery, which was The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. And I think it's just amazing how mysteries and murder mysteries have been a value over 100 years ago, with 150 years ago with Wilkie Collins in the Moonstone, and with Harry Potter just recently. In fact, in one of the Harry Potter, the prisoner of Azkaban or something like that, the wrong wizard was convicted on the basis of eyewitness testimony that was false. And I think it's interesting to see how the young people reading these books are going to possibly be different kinds of jurors than of my generation, where everybody believed what the police said. Now, because of events, because of Watergate, because of people being released, but because of also books like Harry Potter, the generation of jurors in the next 10, 20 years are going to have a more skeptical and critical eye of scientific testimony and police testimony.
Dr. Michael Bodden, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you so much, Barry. Good luck, and really good to talk to you.
Dr. Michael Bodden is the author of Dead Reckoning, The New Science of Catching Killers. The books he recommends for reading are the Harry Potter series and The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Our address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.